Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Brees. Episode 19, Participatory Research with Student Teachers and Their Mentors, with Emma. Hello and welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, where it's now becoming something of a regular ritual to sit down with Emma and ask her how her doctorate's going. You're back.
I am. Sorry, like a boomerang. You thought you'd gotten rid of me.
This is where you get an insight into our different ways of working. Because if you remember, I just went away, said nothing for a really long time and just went, done. But you didn't hear from me for like 3 years or something.
This is true. Whereas I'm super needy. I need to talk it all out at every possible opportunity. I will capitalise on that opportunity to talk about it. Typical drama person.
Well, I think you've just got more going on in yours than I did in mine. So
I don't know about that.
We are now at the stage that you've done your pilot and you've been analysing your data for your pilot, and we're going to be chatting about some of those things in the hope that apart from you getting your story straight, ready for your supervisors, it might also help all the various people who are out there doing this kind of stuff out in the world, whether a master's or a doctorate in education. So just in case anybody has committed the crime of not listening to all your other episodes about your doctorate.
You are forgiven.
Emma will forgive you one day. Remind us what it is that you're trying to find out.
Okay, so I am trying to better understand how student drama teachers develop their pedagogical content knowledge, which is sort of an amalgamation of the thing that you know about what you're about to teach, so your kind of subject knowledge, and how you sort of transform that to be able to teach it, which involves other elements of knowledge, such as knowledge of learners, knowledge of what they know or don't know about the thing you're trying to teach them, knowledge about any misconceptions they might have about the thing you're about to teach them, knowledge of the curriculum and what you have to teach. So it's all of that stuff that a teacher translates and transforms into the pedagogical content knowledge that comes through in their teaching practice. So I wanted to understand that better.
So the magic of being a teacher and how you come to kind of acquire that magic. Okay. And we heard from you last time in a kind of massive double interview where you managed to explain to us all the things that people are most frightened of: ontology, epistemology, axiology. You came to the conclusion that participatory research was a thing that you wanted to do. So just again, in recap mode, if you can just remind us how you ended up choosing what is a slightly interesting approach to this work.
Yeah, without doing another sort of round the houses of axiology, epistemology or ontology, because no one needs that again in their life. But basically, the conclusion that I came to was that I don't want to investigate pedagogical content knowledge from solely my own perspective. So I could investigate it as a thing, you know, just from my own perspective, what I think might be happening, develop my own hypotheses, and then go out and pull together some people, and I try and investigate what's going on from a very sort of personal perspective. I am in charge. I am solely responsible for that research process. What I really wanted to do was to acknowledge that in our teacher education programs here in Wales, we're trying to work in partnership with everybody who sort of is involved in that process. So school-based teacher educators, university-based teacher educators, and the student teachers themselves. So I thought, well, hold on a minute, if I'm sort of doing it to them, that's not really in the spirit of participation. It's not in the spirit of partnership. So I stumbled across this methodology called participatory research methodology, which is basically where you go to the people who are experiencing the thing that you're trying to investigate. And sometimes you actually go to the community and you say, is there a thing that we ought to be investigating? So I didn't quite do that sort of purist approach. I didn't go to them, you know, asking them, is there something we should investigate? I went to them saying, PCK, this is a thing that I think might be important for us to investigate. What do you think? And you set about then with those participants, investigating it, researching it together. And there are sort of various different points in the research process and different levels of participation that you can sort of facilitate from, you know, everybody participates in every single part of the process. So from designing it to gathering the data, the people who were involved in it would gather it, they analyze it, they write it up. Now, of course, this is my doctorate. So one of the issues that came through when I was reading about participatory research methodology is that there are issues of ownership and power. And of course, because this is my doctorate, ultimately, there's only so far I can go in including the people that I have gathered together to help participate in this research with me. There's only so much I can put on them. So this is one of the things I'm sort of learning through this process, really, is that there are times when I have to take control and I have to sort of hold on to the research and drive it. But there are moments, and I'm going to talk about this in today's episode, where it can really invigorate the research in a way that just wouldn't happen if you did it on your own and in a non-participatory way.
Yeah, so as you say, very much in the spirit, I think, of the field in which we work and the kind of particular political or policy landscape in which we do teacher education. So that's what makes that particularly interesting. I suppose from the point of view of those of us cheering on from the sidelines, there are two lines that are interesting in this work. One is what you're going to find out about how drama teachers learn, and I'm sure loads of us will attempt to steal that and work out how that works in other subject areas, but also what you're learning about this approach to research, which I kind of feel a bit surprised we've not encountered before as much. You know, I mean, we've hardly heard about it at all, really, until you brought it to the table. So in the version of the doctorate that you're doing, which is the EdD, which is a little bit more of a structured modular one than the PhD, as we've discussed in the past, you get to do a pilot before you do your sort of big main one. So what were you actually doing with your pilot? What were you trying to find out, and how are you kind of keeping that manageable and small?
Yeah, it's a bit tricky, actually. For those of you who are familiar with pilots, it usually involves trying out a method or an approach that you intend to sort of scale up when you use it in the sort of full fact study. So for you, Tom, didn't you pilot your questionnaire? Is that what you did?
I piloted my interview, actually.
Oh, there
we go. Yeah, piloted my interview, did an initial one with somebody, and then sat down and worked out, firstly, that we'd taken far too long over it because it had gone on for over an hour. And secondly, there was one particular question that I'd done an absolutely terrible job of explaining, which meant I could go away and just have a think about that before I attempted to do it again better.
Yes. So it's a really useful tool. It's kind of the iterative process of sort of sharpening your research tools, really, to make sure that they're going to, you know, work for you in a reliable and sort of valid way when you use them in the main study. But I had to do my pilot, sort of repurpose it and use it in a slightly different way, given that I was going down this participatory methodology route. So what I used it for was to take the concept of PCK to participants, potential participants in the big study, in the main study, because as I said a moment ago, I thought that there was merit in trying to understand how student drama teachers develop their PCK, but I didn't want to choose like what bits of that process or that concept I wanted to understand better. I wanted to put that to student drama teachers themselves, and also to school-based teacher educators who we often call mentors in our model, and to first of all do a little bit of a workshop with them. And this was before I started the audio devices rolling to capture, you know, what they felt would be best to investigate, what they thought had merit to find out about with regard to PCK. Before I could do that, I had to off camera have a conversation with them about what PCK is, to talk it all through, to make sure that they sort of understood that concept. I'm pleased to say that they all recognize that concept, but not necessarily under that term. But it was very, very familiar to both the student teachers and the school-based teacher educators. And I also included a university-based teacher educator, so it wasn't just my perspective as a university-based teacher educator in this whole equation. So basically what I did was I used this pilot to, as part of the design phase of my participatory research methodology, to find out what we researchers should be seeking to better understand or find out more about regarding student drama teachers, PCK, but to also ask them who should participate and how should the research be conducted. So it's sort of putting it to those participants to help me sort of design the methods as well, select the appropriate methods. And this was important because they are living it, and I am not in their shoes experiencing what it is to develop your PCK in a school-based context. Yes, I come into that context occasionally when I do subject visits and observations, but you know, the mentors and the student teachers are working most closely on that. So I really needed to find out, you know, because otherwise I could miss something in designing my research without taking their perspectives on board. So in real terms, what I did was I held two focus groups. I had one with the student drama teachers themselves. And the important thing to know about these student drama teachers is they had done the programme. It was at the end of their PGCE year. So I felt that it was best to ask them how to design it because they could speak from a position of experience and knowledge of what it is to go through this programme. And I sort of had a hunch as well that they might be able to better understand how they were learning from a sort of vantage point, you know, where they're looking back and reflecting on that process. When you're in it, it's sort of harder to really see what's going on. So I did a focus group with them. There were six of those participants. And then I did another focus group, which involved school-based teacher educators, two of them, and another university-based teacher educator, all from within my teacher education partnership where I work. So, you know, they've sort of steeped in the knowledge and understanding and experience of the sort of model of teacher education we use in my context. So I sat them down, and my sort of main research questions that were guiding what I was asking them once I switched on the audio devices was, what should we be seeking to better understand or find out more about with regard to student drama teachers, PCK, and who should participate? How should the research be conducted? And then there was this whole sort of meta layer to this where I was sort of through this pilot trying to understand, you know, what participatory research is all about. What am I learning about participatory research by doing a little bit of it?
So it's time to talk about data, and any listeners who have a tiny violin available may wish to get it out at this stage. For those of us who work in the qualitative field of data collection, we think about data, I suppose, our first image that pops into our mind is lots of numbers in boxes and things. And we talked last time you came in about the difference between quantitative and qualitative data. On the plus side, those of us that work in the qualitative sphere, we don't have to deal with or particularly understand standard deviations and paired t-tests and statistical significance and stuff like that. We like to tell ourselves that the data that we've got is very, very rich and full of really, really nice stuff. I guess the downside is that there is an enormous amount of it, and it is really hard to deal with.
Yes. Yes. So just to give you a bit of scope, I think the focus group with the student teachers is about an hour long and about 27 pages of transcript. And we're not known for brevity, drama teachers. Yeah, no.
It was music teachers, it would have been 8 pages.
The focus group with school and university-based teacher educators was a little bit shorter, but there's a lot of data to get through there because I did ask quite a few questions. It was a semi-structured focus group interview process, so I sort of pre-designed some of the questions, and then, you know, the semi-structured nature of it allows you to ask some follow-up questions if you, as and when you need to. And what's quite interesting actually is that a lot of the sort of follow-up questions that I was asking was sort of aimed at putting things back onto the participants in that focus group to tell me, you know, they were just as a first sort of interesting finding is that there were lots of occasions where the participants were saying, well, what are you trying to do? What outcome are you trying to produce? What are you trying to find out? And then I'd put it back onto them and say, well, what do you want out of this? What is going to be useful to you from this research? Because this is, it really sort of underpins the, I guess you could say, the axiological aspect of participatory research. It really ought to do some good and have benefit for and to the people in the community who are, you know, helping you and participating in this approach. So that's quite interesting. But yes, you end up with a lot of data. And so what you really need, and what some excellent researchers out there have put together into a process through a lot of, you know, experimentation themselves and research themselves, is a way to thematically analyze the data that you've got. Now, Brown and Clark are two sort of big names in the world of thematic analysis. You might have heard of the term coding. I've got to code my data. And that, it doesn't solely sort of rest on their shoulders, didn't solely come from them. But what they've put together is a process that they call a journey. I think they probably wouldn't like me to call it a process, because it's not sort of like you do this step and then you do that step and then you do this step. But it's a an approach that helps you to, at the end of it, sort of process your data into themes. That's your ultimate purpose, is what they say. And from those themes, you can tell this sort of story, this interpretive story about your data, about what you found in the data. So it goes through like a series of phases, the first being where you sort of immerse yourself in everything. So I had to listen to the recordings, I had to read through the transcripts. It's a process of familiarization. And you start to see some themes emerge there. Now, I think in the past, when I did data analysis in my master's, I think I probably stopped there. I maybe did a little bit of coding, and that's where you go into much more granular detail, where you're highlighting lines of text from the transcripts and you're interpreting them with a sort of pithy code title that sort of sums up what that person is talking about. And then, you know, if you see that recurring elsewhere in the data, then you use that same code again and again, where you see it coming up. But I think what I've learned now is that the close, it's sort of this process of getting really close and fine detailed in your data, and then stepping back and going, okay, so where are the patterns now? Now that I've got all of these codes, are there some things that are sort of coming together in a bit of a pattern with a unifying sort of concept with sort of clear boundaries to it? That's when you know you've got a theme. And so that's sort of where I'm at now. They call it a journey because, I thought that quant would be really difficult, but qual is so difficult, because you can go down a bit of a blind alley. You can think that you're onto something and then realize that, oh, actually, no, I was only onto that thing in this one part of the data set, and it doesn't appear anywhere else. So I think it's a thing, but actually it there's no pattern to it. It's just sort of happening once or with that particular group of people, or maybe with that one participant. So you've got to really look for the things that are patterning across the data. So I needed to look at, you know, not only what the student teachers were saying about PCK and what to investigate, but also what the school-based and university-based teacher educators were trying to say. And obviously there was nuance in all of that, but when to develop a theme, it has to be that there's this unifying concept underneath it that brings that data together.
So I guess if anybody listening has not had the joy of thematically coding an enormous pile of transcripts, it's probably worth saying, I suppose, on the one level, it's not that mysterious, in that you can literally just do it with a pile of highlighters if you want to on the printout, and lots of people choose to do that. There is software that helps you with it, but it's kind of tempting to look at that software and assuming it's doing something utterly magic, whereas actually it's not. It's really just doing the same thing as a packet of highlighters would do, but allowing you to save it in digital form. I think the reason that so many qual heads genuflect in the general direction of Brown and Clark is that they really help the researcher walk that line between claiming things for this process that are not true, you know, that we're kidding ourselves. For example, that it's a sort of really, really objective, almost scientific process in which we have no part to play, that we're totally neutral. But also making sure that we don't just do a really, really superficial job of it. So I know that you've seen some of the same things that I have with Brown and Clark. You know, they really don't like people talking, for example, about themes emerging from the data, do they? They sort of say that that implies that it just kind of leaps you out and bashes you between the eyes, whereas actually you've got a much more active role to play.
Yeah, and I think that's why they've developed this idea of reflexive thematic analysis. So they say that in reflexive thematic analysis, you're trying to make meaning of the world that has been presented to you in your data to develop potential patterns of meaning. But yeah, they make the point very strongly and consistently in a book that was kind of like my Bible called Thematic Analysis, A Practical Guide, that you are not objective. You are you are in it. However, they give you some concepts to work with that sort of help you to position yourself when you are analyzing the data. And I'm going to try and do this as painlessly as possible, just to give you two examples. So they talk about when you're analyzing your data, you'll be orientated towards it on a continuum with these two poles. So you might be more inductive, so where the analysis is located within, and coding and theme development is driven by the data content. So basically you're sort of taking that data at face value. You're not using pre-existing theories as lenses to interpret it. You're taking the participants at their word. And now, you know, and you can see that from my perspective, doing participatory research methodology, it's really important that I do take them at their word. However, I've got a bit of a problem because I do know a lot about PCK and the theory behind it. And I also know the theories and some of the issues that can come up in participatory research methodology. So if you're being more deductive, which is at the other end of that continuum from inductive to deductive as an orientation, if you're more deductive, that's where the analysis is shaped by existing theoretical constructs, which provide the lens through which to read and code the data and develop themes. So you're either going to go, right, I'm not looking for anything in particular. I don't know anything about this. I'm just going to take from it what I can. For example, Brown and Clark give the example in the book where they got a load of data from social media of different people writing about childlessness and, you know, all the issues around having or not having children. And they weren't applying a particular theoretical approach to, you know, a psychological framework to interpret that data. They were just taking it at face value, so a more inductive approach. Whereas deductive, you come at it going, okay, I'm looking at it through this particular theoretical lens. So you can see how I had a bit of a problem there, where some things I really did need to take at face value. So if they're saying to me, these people should participate, these are the methods that we think you should use, I really shouldn't be colouring that with any kind of theoretical construct. I should be going, okay, that's really useful. However, it's difficult, isn't it? Because we have experience as researchers and we might have to sort of think, okay, well, how is that actually going to work practically in reality?
Yeah, I've thought about projects I've been involved with where, you know, at the extreme ends, there have been some very deductive bits of analysis I've had to do as part of projects where the people in charge of the project have literally given me the list of codes and the transcripts and said, find these codes in these transcripts. And then I've done really, really inductive work where I've started off with a blank sheet of paper code-wise, and they've kind of organically come out of my transcripts, and then you have to sort of keep going back and checking. Interestingly, I find that I tend to feel happier in the inductive compared with the deductive. I've always got a bit of a worry with the deductive, that it's all a bit prepackaged and we might miss something. But maybe that's something to do with my various ologies. I don't know.
It might be. But this is why Brown and Clark really sort of emphasise the need to be reflexive as you're going through. You know, how am I sort of skewing the data? How am I interpreting it? Why am I interpreting it in that way? And of course, this is another problem with what I've done, is that I analyse these transcripts because there is absolutely no way it was going to be possible, sort of practically really, to say to the people involved, right, okay, now I need you to have a look at these transcripts with me.
And a tough sell.
It would have been a tough sell. So the other thing I want to very briefly mention when you're doing this is that you also sort of lay on a you might sort of stand on a continuum with regard to your focus of meaning. So semantic focus is where you're exploring what is explicitly being said that's quite surface. So another example I gave earlier on is, you know, this person, if we're going to investigate PCK, student teachers need to participate, mentors need to participate. That is, you know, semantic level of meaning there, is that I'm looking for what is explicitly being said. Whereas latent analysis is where it explores the sort of implicit level of what's being said. So for example, I'm going to talk in a little bit about one of my themes, or possibly a sub theme, is the need to be understood, because there was this sort of theme that was coming through that I was reading, that was patterning in the data, that the participants were trying to say, like, I need student teachers developing their PCK to understand that this is important. And the student teacher saying, I need my mentor to understand that this is what's happening to me and that this is important. So they weren't like sort of explicitly semantically saying, right, if you're going to investigate this, then these people need to know this, or these people need to know that. But they're sort of implicitly implying that if we're going to investigate PCK, something we might need to look out for is that everybody involved is going to have a slightly different priority. But ultimately, what we are hopefully going to be trying to do is gain a better understanding of, you know, what everybody's desires are, where everybody's coming from when they're trying to help each other, or when they're the learner trying to develop their PCK.
This is why Brown and Clark are the legends, isn't it? Because you could so easily reduce thematic coding to just playing about with highlighters, and yet this table that's in their book. And by, is this the book with the bingo card of all the things they really hate about analysis? Yeah, including sort of drive-by Brown and Clark. Is it 1996 references? Pronouncing Brown as Brawn, I think, is another one they really, really hate. I love their bingo card. It's great. But it's interesting, this table which you've shown me, where they're talking about the variations in your orientation. It's making me realise that probably the projects I've tended to be involved with have been much more basic, really, on a methodological level than perhaps this one, which is a bit more ambitious. And so I could probably pinpoint a place on all these various continuum things, whereas you're sort of ranging about a bit.
Yes, I am. And I think it's because of my research questions, really, for this part of the pilot. It was, you know, there was the one that was a bit more sort of exploratory, which was, you know, if we're going to be trying to investigate the development of student drama teachers' PCK, what should we be seeking to better understand? And so that's open to a lot of interpretation. So it's no surprise to me that student teachers were talking a lot about a particular element of PCK. You know, teacher educators had their own priorities as well. And so looking for sort of patterns and common ground and nuance in all of that was, you know, was really ripe for thematic analysis. Whereas, as I said earlier on, there were certain things where actually there is a pragmatic and practical element to participatory research, which is that, you know, if you're going to get people participating with you, you've got to listen to what they need and what they can and can't do. And, you know, ethically do them no harm if they are going to be involved. And, you know, so in order to do that, you can't just be reading between the lines and, you know, inadvertently going, oh, well, actually, what they mean is this. You actually have to go, no, that I am seeing again and again that they are telling me these people should participate. These are the sorts of ways that it's best to understand this thing. So there is this sort of this need to be orientated towards the more inductive end for some of this too.
So by this point then, you've got your transcripts, you've got your highlighters, because I believe you're a highlighter person rather than a software person. Is that
right? Well, actually, you know, I because I read Brown and Clark, I did it slightly differently. I used track changes in Word, actually the comment function, and I highlighted, because you can highlight the same extract of text and put multiple comments on it. So I've done it that way. I believe if you're into your sort of is it called macros, you know, it into a spreadsheet that you could then get it to generate, but I'm just doing it by hand. So I've got an Excel spreadsheet, and so for every new code that comes up, I'm adding it to that spreadsheet. I will eventually be sort of quantifying how frequently that's coming up, and then I'll sort of compile under each code all of the data extracts that pertain to that particular code. It's quite labor intensive.
It often is, isn't it? So you're sort of halfway on a continuum. If Brown and Clark have made a continuum about your orientation towards highlighters or software, you're kind of halfway along it, because you're not highlighting bits of paper, which I have done, and you're not using like the Envivo software, which I have done. You're doing something halfway, and I've used comments as well. So you've got this data. You've taken all of this time to really dig into the nuances of it, and in the process realized or come to the realization or dealt with the fact that the data is not a kind of entirely neutral thing. You don't have a neutral position in relation to it. This stuff does not sort of float out of the data and present itself to you, that it is an active process. You have then done some coding of your transcripts. I imagine you were probably locked away for ages doing that. What sort of things started coming out?
Yeah. So basically, once you've done the codes, you then just look at the codes and you go, okay, looking at those codes, can I see any patterns? Are they sort of clustering? And then when they cluster, they become a sort of potential, a contender theme. So I think my contender themes at the moment, in regard to the question, what should researchers be seeking to better understand or find out more about with regard to pre-service or student drama teachers, PCK, I've got three of them. The need to understand how PCK develops. So one of the things that comes through quite clearly is that we need to know how this is happening, which is quite interesting because for those of you who listened to my episode about the literature review, we've got this idea of a dynamic or a static conception or conceptualization of PCK, and you know, just from them saying we need to understand how it develops, it sort of suggests that, you know, it can't just come prepackaged and is taught to the student teachers. This is an idea that they acknowledge that there's some kind of development learning process that they want to better understand. So sitting underneath that is this need to be understood. So the what was coming through in the data was that there are different priorities, as I said earlier on, for teacher educators and pre-service drama teachers. So for the pre-service, for the student drama teachers, they were talking a lot about subject knowledge and about how when you come into a PGC program as a graduate of a drama degree, which might be very, very different, depending on your background. You might have gone to a conservatoire and done an acting degree. You might have done a pure drama and theatre degree in a red brick university or whatever. So lots of different routes. And what they were talking about a lot was that they felt that mentors and teacher educators more broadly needed to understand that the challenge is that you can know something, you think you know your subject really, really well, But then you get into school and that knowledge doesn't necessarily have currency in that location. Sometimes for reasons such as they're not teaching that thing. So it's not going to help you. They're teaching something else. And that is, you know, there's more risk of that in the drama curriculum because historically we've not had a curriculum, and in Curriculum for Wales, there is less prescription. So that's hard. So there was this real need. So in the that broad theme of we need to understand how PCK develops, you've got the student teachers going, and we also, can we make sure part of that is subject knowledge and what's going on there? For the teacher educators, particularly school-based, it was knowledge of learners and knowledge of context. So they really needed researchers doing this to understand, or there was this sort of sub theme of needing to understand that, you know, they've got to get our kids, they've got to, you know, there's no point in teaching your subject to our kids unless you understand our kids and you understand our context. It's not going to land otherwise. So I guess that also feeds into my second theme, big theme, which was that it seemed to me that personal views of the participants in these focus groups were influencing the aspects of PCK that they felt it was important to investigate. So like I said, for pre-service drama teachers, there was this real need to focus on subject knowledge, but also curriculum knowledge, because what they seemed to be saying, and this was reinforced by some of the school-based teacher educators, was that they come in with this knowledge, but the curriculum in that school might be looking at a different practitioner or a different text. So you might have gone to university and learned a lot about a particular topic in depth and detail that sort of fits within a broader area of the curriculum. And then when you come to the school, the mentor will say, oh yeah, but we do this text. So these poor student drama teachers come in, it was a lot of expression of, exasperation from the student drama teachers going, like, the thing that you thought would give you currency, it would set you off on the right foot when you got into school, actually, there was this whole negotiation process that had to go on with the mentor where they were going, oh, well, don't teach that here, but we do, you know, it does fit into this broader area of the curriculum. So I have a hunch that there is something going on when subject knowledge and curriculum knowledge come together, and there's some kind of challenge there that's quite unique for student drama teachers.
And I don't want to kind of open up a can of worms here, which I do, because you know me. But when you think about pedagogical content knowledge as being the magic of being a teacher, and effectively the thing that all of these student teachers are trying to gain as part of the process of learning to be a teacher, I suppose as educators, if we think of it as the thing they need to learn, as educators it's really tempting to think, oh, there must be a sequence, we must be able to do that in order, in a way that is the most efficient and the best way to do that. And yet we've talked about the multi-levelled, you know, complex nature of pedagogical content knowledge. Now we're also talking about the wide variety of lived experience and existing subject knowledge of the students, and we're talking about the wide variety of curriculum approaches and the wide variety of contexts. It's making me feel that the idea of having an actual sequenced approach, you know, one size fits all, I hesitate to say, but an approach to teaching pedagogical content knowledge where you can stick the bits in order feels like it's receding now into the distance as a possibility.
Yeah, well, I suppose there are always, this is another thing with thematic analysis, so there are often sort of contradictory elements, because actually sequencing the elements of PCK came up quite a lot, you know, particularly from the teacher educators. Interestingly, the university-based teacher educators were quite adamant that, you know, both school-based and teacher educators and student teachers need to sort of set about laying out all the things they know at the start and their beliefs about the subject. So that would be sort of step one of the sequence to better understand each other and to support the school-based teacher educator then in differentiating their approach for the needs of that particular student teacher. So like there, the idea of a sequence, you know, holds, doesn't it? Also, the school-based teacher educators were sort of suggesting that step one is you've got to get to know the kids. If you don't know the kids, don't care what subject knowledge you've got, and the same for context, knowledge of context. And actually what came up in that as well was knowledge of curriculum. It was like, you know, unless you know that here we teach frantic assembly, and, you know, that our parents in this particular school expect X, and, you know, all of these things. They're suggesting that if the student teacher doesn't know these things first, then whatever they do to translate their subject knowledge is not necessarily going to land with those pupils. So that, again, there's a hint at a sequence there. But you're right, Tom, the other thing that came up was this idea that there is differentiation in PCK development, that every student is different. You know, that came up a lot, that phrase, you know, of course every student's going to be different, of course every student's going to be different. But then what that leads us to is this idea, you know, going back to the big theme, the need to understand how PCK develop and the role of the teacher educator and pre-service drama teacher sort of in that process. So I anticipate, and this came through in the sort of how should we investigate it bit, that there will be a reflective element to this whereby university and school-based teacher educators will step back at intervals and try to together understand what's going on and what the consequences are for their teacher education practice. So I have a hunch that, and I certainly won't be able to investigate it in this doctorate, but that there will be a teacher educator's PCK and maybe even a teacher student drama teacher educators PCK. So if you're educating a drama teacher, then you've got a particular PCK that you need to have to know about how you develop your student drama teacher's PCK. Now if that sounds like Inception too many layers, then I'm sorry if I've lost you there. But basically we need to understand what's going on is what I was hearing from these participants in all of its nuance, and then step back together. And they were quite adamant about this, that this was the point where the participants said, yeah, we need the university-based teacher educator to be involved in this. You need to be with us to make sense of this. Where we're stepping back and we're going, okay, what's going on here? And what does this mean for us? So what?
Well, that's quite refreshing, isn't it? Because there's quite a lot of evidence out there in the literature that sometimes it's the university-based teacher educators that can be seen as a complete irrelevance.
Yes, yes, absolutely that. So, you know, I was quite heartened by that. So, and I think what will hopefully come through, and this was another theme that I've sort of touched upon that came through, but it's worth mentioning again, is that hopefully the unique facets of the challenges that pre-service or student drama teachers face when they're developing their PCK will come through in this study, which obviously makes it very niche, but that's, I guess, really important, is that there are a lot of studies out there about how science and maths teachers develop their PCK, an abundance of them, and there is only one that I know of that talks about student drama teachers' PCK. So in the data there was, you know, this idea that subject knowledge, what subject knowledge and how much, can be a bit of a challenge. Curriculum knowledge, as I mentioned earlier on, it's really important that teacher educators you know, lay that out for the student drama teacher, but they, you know, they're not going to be able to anticipate what's going to come up in every single school in the partnership. The knowledge of learners as being a bit of a challenge, because there's no shortcut way of giving them that knowledge. They've got to get to know those kids properly. And the knowledge of the context, again, that's a bit of a slow burner. So all of those are particular challenges that hopefully we can sort of unpick some of the nuances of in this study.
Well, niche is good in doctorates, so I'm led to believe. I like the way you also talk about, I can't find this out in this doctorate, implying there's going to be another one after this one. It's quite a scary thought, doctor. However, lots of clues about already starting to emerge about this very elusive process of attaining or getting PCK. You were, or there is, this is supposed to be a pilot, and you were also asking them what they thought about how you should go about the main study. Frightening to think there's still a main study after all of this exciting stuff you've done. What sort of things did they have in mind for you then?
Yes. Okay, so they felt strongly that, as I've said a few times, student teachers should participate, school-based teacher educators should participate, and university-based teacher educators should participate. The student teachers, and this came through in both focus groups, it was felt that would be best at participating at the end of the PGC or at the end of a placement. And it was felt that they would be better placed at reflecting backwards. I mentioned that earlier on in this episode. The other thing that was interesting that the student drama teachers felt was necessary to investigate was the idea that peer support for pedagogical content knowledge happens continuously, often in informal spaces. So they talked a lot about how, you know, if something's come up in school and they've got to teach it and they know a bit about it generally, but they don't really know how, you know, the different options for how they could teach it, they'll put it in their WhatsApp thread and their peers will say, oh, I'm teaching that here and you could try this and you could do this. And this idea that, you know, similar to what we find in teaching, that if a peer is explaining it to another peer, then it might land a bit more clearly, it might be a bit easier to understand. Also, they talked about that happening quite regularly when they went to university. So they'd say, you know, they'd land in the cafeteria and the first thing they do is be saying, right, I've got this that's going on and how would you teach this thing? Oh, I've got an idea for this. So they really felt that it was important to capture how PCK is developing informally, peer-to-peer, in those less traditional spaces. And then we had this sort of pattern across a placement that was recommended in the focus groups, which was that dialogue between student teachers and school-based teacher educators, their mentors, could be captured at sort of key points. So they have formal lesson observations at 3 points in their first placement, and I come in at 1 point. So they felt that those would be really important points where, you know, the mentor is talking to the student teacher about how they planned a particular lesson. It was felt that actually the lesson plan might be a really useful source of data that could over time show how the student teacher's PCK is developing, or certainly how they're sort of how they are prioritizing certain elements of PCK, or how they're sort of developing their understanding of different elements and how that's sort of improving their PCK overall. And then there would be this sort of stepping back of that. So that conversation would be recorded between student, teacher and mentor. And then school-based teacher educator and university-based teacher educator would come together, listen to that and go, okay, what are we finding out about this? And that would be happening, you know, you'd have to be very careful with sample size here, but let's say you had, you know, 4 student drama teachers and their 4 mentors and then their university-based teacher educator, which of course would be me. So actually that would produce a lot of quite rich data, even though maybe there are some of you out there going, gosh, that doesn't sound like a lot of people. But if you think about the amount of data that would produce, that could potentially teach us quite a lot about what's going on. A focus group then at the end where the student teachers are also sort of reflecting back on what happened to them and how their PCK developed, so that you've definitely got their voices in all of this. So, yeah, they were quite rigorous and meticulous in how they wanted to investigate this. And it was heartening to know that they really wanted this opportunity to step back and figure out what it meant for their practice, which I guess speaks to this idea of participatory research methodology, because it perhaps is going to make research useful and have a sort of sense of utility in a way that research that's done to a community perhaps misses.
So they've given you lots of jobs to do, which is nice of them. I suppose thinking about our listeners who may not be about to carry out a very, very niche doctorate, but who may be listening to this because of the participatory research angle, which I think has got much wider applicability to all these people out there who these days are doing masters and doctorates and things like that while they're in the classroom. Where are you standing now on this participatory research thing? It sounds like it's done you good and all, in a weird way, it's done your participants good as well, because it sounds like they had loads of fun doing that.
Yeah. I think, you know, just anecdotally, the vibe in these focus groups was positive, and they felt, it seemed to me that people felt that they were enjoying having these conversations, which was quite nice, and they felt glad to have been asked. But getting into the detail, what I did do actually was that I interviewed one to one. I didn't actually interview them, but I got a member of the team that was unknown to the school-based teacher educators and the university-based teacher educator involved to interview them, just to ask them, you know, what do you think, how involved do you feel, if you carry on with this project, what would you need to help you? So that, you know, they had a forum, they weren't just saying things that they felt I wanted or needed to hear, that they could sort of be honest and open about participating in this and whether they thought it had merit. So what I've learned is that what was another theme throughout was the fact that it was prompt by virtue of asking people how should we investigate this thing and what should we investigate, people were reflecting on teacher education practice and how student teachers learn. You know, when you start to think, well, how would we investigate it, you have to talk about, well, what's happening, and reflecting on practice, which was, I think, a very useful thing for us to be doing together. There were issues of power and ownership, and this mainly came from me, I'd say, because I still feel that I'm swinging between being a facilitator, but also one who is very much responsible for bringing this research into land. So, you know, there is an issue of power and ownership there. I'm learning that participatory research requires participants to draw on their own knowledge of research. So it was quite interesting to hear that the student teachers who've just come fresh from a PGC, having done two master's level assignments, were drawing upon their knowledge of doing that research in order to make recommendations about how I research it. So one point came up where somebody felt quite strongly that the whole PGC drama cohort should be involved in the research, because they remembered when they had to do an inquiry into their own practice, that they felt that if it was going to involve them making some form of intervention, that everybody in the class ought to receive that, otherwise it wouldn't be ethical. So it was really interesting to sort of hear them drawing upon that in order to help me shape, help us shape this research. Something that came through quite strongly, because it was participatory and because these participants are living the programme and are potentially going to be researching it, was the care and consideration about, you know, the sort of methods that you use, such that they don't inflict too much burden on them in terms of their time and their workload. And something that came through very strongly from the student drama teachers was the need to be appreciative and positive, because they get a lot of critique on the programme. So if the research was just adding another layer of, you know, negative critique, then, you know, it might not be particularly helpful. But the thing that I think is absolutely key, that I absolutely wouldn't, I don't think this would have happened had I used a different methodology, is that I couldn't have considered the dimensions to investigate about PCK and the approach to it on my own had I not consulted them, which seems like a bit of an obvious one, but I don't know, it just feels like a much more robust way of producing something that could actually make change to our practice, which is what the EdD, the prof duck at my institution, is all about. It has to result in some kind of change. And I feel like this is much more in the spirit of partnership and changing together.
Makes me think there's something in this even for people that are not doing research type projects, really. I suppose we think about all these times when we're in schools or when we've worked in places where people sort of say, oh, what do you think about this? And actually, if we were to all step back and say, how do you think we ought to find out about this? You might actually get a much more interesting range of responses and potentially some more creative solutions to your various problems.
Yes, that. I mean, that's something to try,
isn't
it?
There we go, yes.
If you asked your pupils, you know, yeah. how should I find out about this? You know, that and then just do some really simple, have a go at thematic analysis with what they, with what, you know, based on what they come up with.
Yeah, maybe if you're a sort of middle leader or a senior leader, and maybe you do this already, but maybe instead of sort of saying, right, you know, we've got this issue, or we've got this in our Estin report, or this number's, you know, pointing in the wrong direction on this spreadsheet, what are we going to do about it? Maybe stepping back, how are we going to find out what we're going to do about this? What are the range of options? Could be an interesting thing. There we go. I've donated you something to try. That's my gift to you.
Thank you.
Something interesting. I think we have to genuflect once again.
We do. So the book that I'm recommending, if you'd like to dabble in this, and I cannot stress enough how accessible this book is. This really is not something that you would pick up and you're going to have, you know, a dictionary handy for every single word. It's really close to practice. It holds you by the hand all the way through this process. And it's called Thematic Analysis, A Practical Guide by Virginia Brown and Victoria Clark. And it's published by Sage. And it's very recent for those of you who are concerned about recent and relevant texts, 2022. It was published. So yeah, add that to your reading list.
They really are the names where this stuff is concerned, isn't it? You see them in all sorts of papers, and I've seen them on Twitter and things like that. They come across as quite down to earth, actually, as people.
Yes, and something I'll say for this book, and they say it right at the beginning, talking about, you know, sort of your worldview. They admit to having been quite ableist about thematic analysis in the past, you know, being a little bit purist about doing it by hand. And they write this book with little sort of episodes where they're referring to people that might find, for various different reasons, thematic analysis quite challenging. So for example, if you're somebody with ADHD, how you manage that process. They've really considered the variety of people who might be applying this method and have tried their very best to make it as sort of inclusive as possible, this book.
Great. Well, before we go, I suppose I have to ask you the time-worn question. What are you going to be up to next then?
Crikey. Doing what they've told me to do, I guess. So yeah, I need to pitch this to them, of course, now, because, you know, you do the analysis, and then, you know, the next step in participation is to say, does this ring true? And, you know, do you still want to go on this journey with me? Hopefully the answer will be yes. And then we'll do the do. and then, you know, write it up, and hopefully it will then go some way towards finding its way into sort of mentor professional learning, shared more broadly with university-based teacher educators of drama. I'd really keen to give back to them. Maybe some co-authored papers with the participants in this study, because, you know, again, it's really important that they are acknowledged that the work gets out there in ways that are accessible to everybody working with student drama teachers.
Well, there we go. We look forward to having you back in the hot seat after you've been doing the do. I'm sure you'll be back after an appropriate period of time. Hopefully there's something in there for various listeners, whether you're a real sort of niche drama specialist, whether you're an education researcher, perhaps you're embarking on master's or doctoral research from within the classroom, or maybe, as we said before, you're somebody who just wants to find out about some stuff in school, and maybe there's some food for thought there. Thanks to Emma for letting us wring a few more bits out of her doctoral research for the purposes of content. And we will be back with you in 2 weeks' time. You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Doher and Tom Breeze. Thanks to Emma for putting herself back in the hot seat and taking us another step along her doctoral journey. We hope there's something in there for everyone. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. We're on social media at Talk Teaching Pod if you want to come and say hello. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.